You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the week of February 22nd through the 28th. I'm Sarah Custer. In this week's edition, we'll be talking about a university in the UK that has locked up an interesting addition to campus facilities. Then we'll look at the growth of grand challenges on US campuses. But first, we'll go to our features editor, Paul Jump, to go over the results from the Times Higher Education VC Salary Survey. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Can you just go over, this is our, which edition of the VC Salary Survey is this?
Well, we've been doing it for many years. This one is based on the latest accounts, but it's for the year 16-17, so it's a sort of year in arrears, basically.
Okay, and can you tell us what does the survey show? Is it just the yearly salary, or does it break it down a bit more?
It does break it down a bit more. It looks at bonuses, benefits, that kind of thing, and also pension, which is often a very significant element of the overall remuneration that vice-chancellors get.
So tell us what did the results show this year? What's the average percent change this year compared to last year's survey?
Yeah, well, it depends which one you look at. If you look at the total salary, which would include benefits and things like that, it's 3.9%. If you include pension as well, you get a slightly different figure, 3.2%.
So that's a 3.2% rise
on the 15-16 figure. So that's the annual rise, which you might say isn't very much. But then again, if you consider that academics, common or garden academics, only got 1.1% that year, puts it in some perspective.
And who are the top three winners, I guess, if you could call them winners?
Well, I mean, again, it depends. It depends exactly what you look at, really. In many cases, and this is the same every year, the highest sort of payout on the Vice Chancellor's office is often by universities that have had more than one VC in office in that year, mm-hmm. because the departing VC often gets some kind of payoff. So the top one is Bath Spa University by a mile. This isn't a new figure. I mean, this was reported before, but Christina Slade, who was their VC, got a total of 808,000. In that year, which is by some distance the highest, but that again included a very large payoff when she left, over 400,000. So again, it's very skewed by that. Sussex as well had a high layoff, but a high payout rather, but that's because they had two VCs. So I think that probably the highest one that isn't skewed in some way or other is John Raftery at London Met, whose salary rose by 28%, 28.6% in fact. Mm.
And we spoke with London Met in the piece, didn't we? And they gave a reasoning for...
We did. Well, they made the point that, you know, London Met has improved a lot under his leadership. You know, when he took it over, it was obviously in a bit of a state. You know, it had been rocked by various scandals, and financially it was in a bit of a mess. So, you know, in that sense, he has steadied the ship. It's improved some of its performance and things like graduate outcomes and stuff. So I think they felt that he merited the rise. Mm. I mean, it has to be said, his salary still isn't huge by sector standards.
What's the total?
Well, if you include pension, it's 328,000, which is above the average, but not massively above it.
Mm. And who were the losers, I guess? They're not losers, obviously, but the least highly paid vice chancellors in our exercise. Who was that?
Yeah, well, again, it's a slightly difficult figure to give because, you know, you're not quite comparing like with like. A lot of the lowest earners are from specialist colleges, a lot of them to arts institutions. Rittle College is actually the lowest, which obviously isn't a university at all, but does do some HE. Mm. Its leader only got 136,000, so a pauper really by sector standards. Among those, you've also got things like the University of Suffolk or Newman University, which obviously only recently became universities and they're still quite small. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, they're the kind of institutions you'd expect really to be lower down the salary list.
The topic of VC pay has dominated headlines, not least of which the headlines on TimesHigherEducation.com and in our magazine. And a lot of it has been around Dean Glynis Breakwell, from the University of Bath, who announced her retirement as a result of the controversy around this topic. And a lot of the blame has been placed on the councils, the governing councils of universities. And and in this piece, Jack Grover wrote this, in this piece, he speaks with some people about this topic, about where blame should lie and if governors have a responsibility to stand up against the rising salaries. What does our piece say?
He does. Well, he spoke to a student at Bath who'd done an FOI request to find out the backgrounds of all their governors, and had found that they, you know, they all very much move in the same circles, a lot of them from corporate background as well, which obviously skews their perspective in terms of what a reasonable salary would be. Also included in the piece is an analysis done by a retired management consultant who's submitted some evidence to the one of the select committee inquiries into all of this. And he, you know, that very much shows as well that by sort of other standards of other sectors, even other sort of quasi public sectors, public agencies and things like that, vice chancellors are actually arguably underpaid if you take into account how large universities are in terms of how many people they're, at least in principle, managing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's obviously reflected in the governance, you know, the fact that these salaries don't seem outlandish to governors. But then there is also all the controversy over the vice chancellor's input into their own remuneration, and you know, some sit on the remuneration committees, others sort of attend them in some way or other.
Yeah, and in the piece it said, what was it?
Yes, I don't remember the exact figure, but it's quite a high proportion. It's
something like 91 VCs sit on the remuneration committee.
Yeah, that was researched by the UCU, the union. The extent to which they actually directly influence that process is very much moot. I mean, you know, they're kind of there in the background, but I don't think anybody's suggesting that they're actually just, you know, writing the number down on a piece of paper that they want and everybody else nodding it through. But nevertheless, the fact that they are so hand in glove with their governors and sort of move in similar circles. In Glynis Breakwell's case, of course, she's been there for many years as well, so it's obviously very well, very intimate with the governors. So, you know, in that kind of situation, you know, you can see why the governors probably wouldn't challenge a higher warden, indeed might well argue for one.
And in this piece we do compare, going to your point about comparing these salaries with commercial leaders and CEOs in other industries, this piece does do a good job of breaking down a little bit of that. And Jack spoke with Michael Nesbitt, who has done some research on this. And Michael Nesbitt actually says this isn't that big of a deal, really, whenever you look at inflation costs and comparing it to organizations of similar sizes as universities.
He does. I mean, of course, some people argue that, you know, that's not really a fair comparison and that universities shouldn't be likened to the likes of Network Rail or the BBC or the Bank of England, which are some of the other organizations he looks at. You know, that's very much open to argument. But if you do confine the analysis to size of organisations in that kind of quasi-public sector area, then the graph we've got in on page 48 of this week's edition does highlight very clearly that vice-chancellors are at the lower end of the pay scale.
We've done this survey a few years in a row now. What's the point of this exercise, Paul? Why do we do this?
Oh, it's all about clicks. it's something that people are obviously very interested in. They always are. It always gets a lot of interest. And I suppose what it comes down to is the perception that leaders of universities and indeed lots of other organisations are sort of increasingly out of touch with the people that they manage. And one of the ways that that's manifested, you know, most clearly is in terms of the pay ratios, the multiple of pay that they get compared to what everybody else gets. So I think that's part of the reason. I mean, we're told as well that universities themselves take an interest in this, not least so that they can see where their VC is on the scale and whether, in fact, they might be underpaying them.
Anything is a benchmark.
It's a benchmark, yes. And, you know, I suppose you could argue that it's part of the problem in a way. If people think that their VC is being underpaid by sector standards, that the salaries get ratcheted up. Obviously, that rarely works in reverse. If somebody sees that their VC is quite overpaid by sectoral standards, it's very rare and probably quite difficult
contractually to bring their salary right down again. So you could see how it might have an inflationary effect. But nevertheless, you know, that's, we're journalists. We just put the information out there. What people do with it is up to them.
Well, you can do what you want with that information. In this week's magazine, on page 38 and also on timeshighereducation.com. So, Rachel, on to you. Hi.
Hi.
You have written an article about grand challenges and the growth of them on U.S. campuses. And can you just tell us, what are grand challenges?
Yes, grand challenges, they're specific research goals designed to boost science in a particular area. So they're usually set to achieve a big national or global ambition. The most famous one is probably the moonshot, which was set by JFK to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. They succeeded. But more recently, you'll recognise them as research goals to cure cancer, for instance, or make a region completely carbon neutral, that kind of thing.
And in your article, you talk about a report from UCLA that's found this trend is growing among US institutions.
Yeah, so they've become hugely popular in the last few years, the last 5 or 6 years in particular, where we've seen a spurt in the number of universities who are taking up this approach by themselves, often with charities or with government funding. So in the US, this report by the University of California, Los Angeles, estimates that there are 20 major institutions in the US and Canada that are currently involved in these large challenges.
Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, so for example, UCLA has two grand challenges underway. The first is to make LA County fully operational on renewable energy by 2050. The second is to end depression as we know it, so they say by the end of the century. So as you can see, they're vastly different from traditional research goals, you might say, in that, you know, you're looking at a century pretty much or beyond even for some of these ambitions. The author of this report from UCLA, she's pointed out herself that actually she'll probably be dead by the time these grand challenges are even coming towards their finale. So the question is, how do you measure something over such a long period of time? And how do you even, you know, what happens if you don't achieve that goal?
And I'm interested to hear your opinion about what these goals are. They seem to be quite broad, arguably a bit woolly. I mean, ending depression in 100 years or having a whole city dependent on renewable energy in 30 years. What's your take on these?
Yeah, it's mixed, really. So these US institutions would probably argue that setting such an ambitious goal over such a long period of time actually gives researchers more stability in their work. They're not under as much pressure to publish quickly. They presumably don't have to worry so much about where their funding's going to come from in the next foreseeable future. There's also the argument that it gets the public behind research as well. If the government, if it's taxpayers' money that's contributing to research, having such an accessible goal like curing cancer, that's something that pretty much everyone, even if you don't have any understanding of research and have no interest in university funding, can get behind. So arguably it's quite positive PR for the universities as well. Of course, the counter argument is, like we said, it's such a broad spectrum. You know, how do you monitor that? A lot of researchers who focus on basic research will also argue, well, in fact, they say they feel uncomfortable with the amount of activity that's being centred on these really big, fashionable goals. They probably worry that the smaller, the more niche research will be neglected, perhaps, if a lot of the funding is going towards these big public affairs.
Interesting. Well, you can find out more about the moonshots taking place on U.S. campuses on page 22 of our magazine. So, Matthew, over to you. You have, hi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
You have an interesting piece in this week's magazine coming out of Canterbury Christchurch University in a new purchase that they have recently made.
Yes, yes. I once wrote an article about all the strange buildings owned by British universities, and they own a castles and grottos and even a sewage plant. But this is a prison which came up for sale at the land just adjacent to the campus, and it was which had been a prison from 1808 for almost that whole period. And it was kind of an obvious, it was just adjacent, so it was an absolutely obvious purchase to expand the campus rather than expanding, you know, bits and pieces all around Canterbury.
Mm. And it was 1808 up until quite present day, wasn't it?
Yes,
up
until 2013. And most recently, housing foreign nationals, I think, people who were about to be deported and so on.
And what's the plan for the prison? What are they going to do with it?
Well, I think the main point is to buy the land, and they're going to create a big engineering building. They're going to create a sort of plaza. They're also going to... the campus... New campus is on an old pilgrimage route which joins St Martin's Church, I think it's called, which is, I think, the oldest church in the English-speaking world that's still used, with Canterbury Cathedral. So they're kind of going to open up that route, which was used in the Middle Ages. The prison itself, in a sense, is a little bit more of a problem because it's a listed building. It's like the hexagonal gatehouse. And one of the wings, and they're listed, so they can't pull it down. So the plans for that is to turn that into a heritage centre in the longer term. I mean, the Vice Chancellor admitted that inside the wing, it's now kind of a row of cells with individual loos. So it's going to take a little bit of. I mean, obviously the building is part of the heritage, so it kind of, in a way, it works quite well. But I think it will.
But surely that's quite a useful management tool to keep there, you know, somewhere to put recalcitrant academics.
Recalcitrant academics or students, yes, yes, indeed. Yes, that's the other option. And, of course, they're going to be using history of the centre and the local the cathedral and so on, but also they've been people researching, particularly a researcher called Maurice Tennant has been looking at the history of the prison itself, and the most incredibly poignant stories, people, you know, sent to prison for years for stealing apples and people who, you know, committed suicide just because they couldn't deal with prison life, even though they hadn't yet come up for trial. And that one point, I don't think there were ever capital punishment ever carried out there, but there were some prisoners who were going to, it was being discussed whether they should be executed, and all their letters were therefore read by the Home Office partly with a view to determining whether capital punishment was appropriate or not. So these letters, quite fairly poignant to read, considering what, that these letters were being judged. For such a grave purpose,
right?
So all that will probably form part of the Heritage Centre, which is, you know, a fair way down the line, probably 10 or 15 years. But in the meantime, the land is being used for some major redevelopment.
Great. Well, thanks for that, Matthew. You can find out more about that purchase on page 14 of the magazine, alongside some of the fascinating stories, as you said, of some of the past inhabitants of the prison near Canterbury Christchurch University. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week for another Times Higher Education issue review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.